Broncos.
So everyone, thank you for joining us. I'm Nick from Fluid.
And I'm Rory from Queer Ear.
Welcome to this special one-off podcast as part of LGBT Plus History Month. Together, we're having a really special conversation with Kerry Hutton and Sayan Savan. Kerry is a human rights campaigner and facilitator who has worked for the rights of people with HIV and AIDS, refugees, migrants, asylum seekers, and people suffering from homelessness. Sayan Savan is an actor who most recently appeared on Channel 4's It's a Sin by Russell T Davies, playing the role of Muslim female queer lawyer Lisbeth Faruqi. This conversation is really important to us because it is regarding the AIDS crisis in the 80s, a lot of queer history of which we don't know today.
I think that we both really wanted to record this episode because we were quite affected by certain themes that came up in It's a Sin, and we wanted to understand the history behind the programme a little bit better by speaking to people who were involved in the show itself and also those who were literally there at the time when this was happening.
Yeah, this is like a really important conversation because this is a lot of kind of queer history that we're not aware of perhaps in our generation so much. And the radio silence, you know, of the AIDS crisis in subsequent years meant that we couldn't mourn for those lives lost, but also it's kind of kept the queer community at a bit of a loose end in terms of what's been going on historically in Britain in the last, you know, 40, 50 years.
And just on that note, we now want to bring things up to speed and we want to find out not only more about that past, but also about where we're going through the eyes of ourselves and also our guests that we're speaking to today.
Absolutely. So we hope you enjoy and let's jump in. So Sayan, I wanted to start by asking you like how you're doing, how you're feeling about It's a Sin after it's been released.
Oh, I'm good. Thank you. It's been a beautiful whirlwind. Yeah, I always use those words. I was saying those words to Russell as well. It's been beautiful to see how the show's connected with audience members and to see how they've connected with all of the characters, because all the characters are so diverse and they represent so many people and untold stories. But more than anything, it's beautiful that these souls have finally been given a voice on mainstream TV. It's been great. Yeah.
And Sayan, you know, one thing I kind of want to point out is the character that you play, from the minute you walked on screen, it was so impactful. You know, I actually think I audibly said, oh my God, I love her in that first scene that you're in. And so I just wanted to know about, you know, how you managed to take on that person, because I think when you're an actor, obviously there's going to be a certain amount of pressure that comes with playing any role. But with a project like this, where you're playing real people who were there and lived this extremely profound experience, what was it like stepping into those shoes and really taking that character on?
Yeah, I think first for me, I only really go for things that really mean something, can connect with me, and are things that I really want to discuss with audience members. And immediately when I got the script, I know we all felt like this, I couldn't stop flicking the pages. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I needed to know not just Lisbeth, but all these people. I really wanted to be close to these young boys and these men. My mum is a lawyer and she connected me to Rohana Popal, who's this country's first British Afghan human rights lawyer. She's amazing work for refugees, and Alexander Swain. So going into work with them every single day. And that entry point when Lisbeth comes in, a lot of that is based off of Rohana. When I went into her chambers in Temple, there was a huge Afghan flag as a tablecloth on her desk and huge banners of the Afghan flag behind her in Temple. And it was just her power and her need to help refugees really struck with me. And then the second key person would be Professor Margaret Johnson, who created one of the first HIV wards in AIDS wards here. And her research for HIV is still so important and prolific. And what really struck me about that meeting was that since the 80s, I was the first person that had come to her and asked her about what she had seen. Through her, I got to know personal accounts of these people, and they stayed with me.
Terry, what do you think listening to Sayan talk, like, how does that kind of fare with your experience of being around literally at the time of the 80s, going through all these kind of legal battles?
So, I mean, I left university in 1985, and so it was that thing, you know, I was of the generation who kind of had their rights of passage and their youth kind of gradually got hijacked, really, by what was happening around us. So I started working in the field in 1988, and there was quite a lot of work already, which was around looking at the multiple discriminations which were coming up. And I gather that the case which you, you know, look at is the specific incident which was in the Manchester hospital, the appalling thing that happened there.
Yeah.
And of course there you had the act, you know, you had people protesting and activists and whatever, but the use of law as such was quite difficult. I mean, at the time, you know, going in to take a case based on HIV discrimination was a difficult thing to do. And so Immunity Legal Centre, which I worked for in the end, I mean, we did a number of things. One of them was to kind of try and seek out HIV-related discrimination and tackle that head on. But actually finding cases to take against specific bodies was quite difficult for a number of reasons. More than that, what one was doing was kind of constantly batting back against potential increased discrimination. There was already stigma, there was already prejudice, people were already getting dog shit on their doors. That was already happening. Mm-hmm. But then there were attempts to kind of criminalise, sometimes by the back door, i.e. Like that Manchester case, and discriminate against and make life even worse than it was already by public health practitioners or by people providing housing or employers or whoever it was. So it wasn't necessarily taking legal cases. It was also raising awareness of the fundamental dignity and rights of people with HIV and AIDS that kind of a lot of us were engaged on doing from the end of the 80s onwards. Immunity Legal Centre itself, quite a lot of its work was taking cases which were, if they didn't get tackled, were fundamentally going to undermine the health of people diagnosed. And then very quickly, of course, they would, at that point, they were diagnosed and death. So in fact, a friend of mine today, I was telling him I was doing this, and he said, I contacted Immunity when I was at Body Positive. And I think, you remember what they did for you? And he said, yes, I had finance cards and debt and so on to unravel. And I was being chased by people, and I just didn't know what to do. And so we took on those kinds of very practical things where you just needed, you know, a bit of backup, really, legal backup, a bit of heft, as well as cases which were like discrimination cases where people were languishing in appalling housing or whatever, as well as asylum and immigration cases, which actually came to be our biggest area of work, as well as employment cases, or wills, living wills, all of that stuff. So it was legal work which helped people as far as possible keep healthy, as well as combating discrimination. It's quite a messy field, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kerry, you know, you've mentioned a lot of examples there. Obviously, the famous Manchester case, or infamous, really, I should say. And, you know, lots of cases that I'm not aware of. And I think certain cases the general public won't be aware of as well. So I'm wondering if there's anything really specific you worked on that might not be in our consciousness that really stands out to you. And then equally, Sayan, if there's a case you learnt about, or even something that we saw in the show that was based on real life that's really stuck with you, because no spoilers, but you were really fighting for Colin, and, you know, his story really has stayed with me since watching the programme. So maybe could you both talk a little bit about those cases that remain with you?
Cases that I particularly remember are to do with asylum seekers. So we have many asylum seekers who came to Immunity, and the government is now hostile to asylum seekers even more than it was, but it wasn't terrifically friendly then. But we were arguing cases and trying to get cases accepted where HIV status and the potential for being discriminated against on that basis, were they to be returned, got recognised as a as a fundamental reason for them to, as a strengthening point in their claim for asylum. And then there was, we did have an employment case as well. Employment cases were really difficult to find. I mean, they are generally very difficult to find and argue on the basis of a single characteristic. But we did get one, because the trouble was often with employment cases that you would have an employment case, but then there would be cofactors about, and which the employer would hold up about why they had got rid of the person. You know, for instance, they were sick and they didn't turn up to work and that sort of thing. So it rapidly got quite messy, unemployment. I remember we had one case where quite definitely HIV was found to have been the reason why they had sacked them. So that was a kind of quite a milestone case as well.
So I think first, before I go to the cases, what really struck me was the waterfall effect of it. As a decade, it very much so, from what I found in through research that I wasn't there, it really was a state-sanctioned, homophobia from the highest places, religious organizations, churches, the government, the police, and the Conservative government at that time being led by Margaret Thatcher. Her speech, her rhetoric, her discourse, everything was so homophobic. It intensified the what the LGBT community were going through, what people who had HIV/AIDS were going through, the amount of police arrests, the amount of discrimination, and then obviously bringing in Section 28, which banned the promotion of homosexuality.
Somebody said to me, and this was early on in the 80s or something, they said, the thing about HIV is it's a bit like a barium meal for the world. All the existing prejudices and discriminations and so on are getting highlighted, you know, so all the people the world love to hate are hated even more through this bloody disease. And that was actually what kind of burned behind the whole process of the UK Declaration of Rights, because what do you do in that situation? Because actually it was the fact that gay people were not treated with dignity and equality that fundamentally undermined the ability to get information out, the ability for people to be honest and therefore hear what they needed to hear. I did a big project on sex education in schools, I remember, which was all about, you know, because in schools people still weren't getting information that they needed to keep themselves safe. So we actually managed in that campaign to get the Mothers Union on side, go figure. And the reason why we got the Mothers Union on side and talking to the then Tory government was because they were scared for their grandchildren. And they could be scared for their grandchildren who were gay, whereas parents were bigger gatekeepers and were like, no, we don't want to.
I wonder, Kerry, what were the strategies that you used in this time to kind of make the AIDS crisis more compelling, you know, off the back of literally what you're just saying, that the people that are most affected by this virus, there are already prejudices existing in society?
So, I mean, people organised, and gay men organised to reach out to gay men massively. But so, you know, there was a very feisty cohort from London Lesbian Gay Switchboard and Capital Gay onwards, which was built on and very rapid, and then Terence Higgins Trust was set up. And so that was all about people, I mean, as I gather it's a sin kind of sets out, that was all about the community helping itself because nobody else was going to. So, you know, people got really clever really quickly. They were researching everything they could get and circulating that information amongst the people who wanted to know. In terms of kind of strategies for getting out to people who didn't think it was their issue, that was the biggie, really. So the number of people who just didn't believe it could happen to me. Where I worked, which was at the National AIDS Trust before I worked at the Immunity Legal Centre, we were looking at kind of national campaigns. And when I mentioned about the sex education one, that was one of the ways in which one of our strategies was to reach out to generic or generalist organisations and get people to talk about their personal experience and what had happened to them. So a fantastic organisation called Positively Women, founded by Caroline Guinness, Kate Thompson and Lee Neal. They were all diagnosed very early on and bravely and marvellously put their face on TV and spoke out publicly. And they went to meet with Princess Diana, came to several, you know, we got kind of the great and the good, if you like, in the room, as well as telling stories about people who they would regard as normal people who had got infected by HIV and AIDS. And that kind of increasingly brought support from outside the usual suspects, as it were. That all said, it was extremely difficult to get over to people for many, many years. That it did affect, or it could affect you, that it was down to you to kind of protect yourself. I used to do speeches as a woman who was shaking a loose leg in London. I mean, I was a out bi woman used to do kind of speeches and sessions, and I did a couple in kind of quite public places about the fact that, you know, I sometimes, in spite of knowing all the risks and in spite of working in the field, still sometimes had unsafe sex. And it was kind of, so encouraging that kind of honesty and people to speak out felt fantastically important, because there was a kind of presumption that you just give somebody information and then, you know, they stop doing whatever it is you want them to do. And of course, this is about the absolutely central thing in our life, which is identity and sexuality and who we are. Yeah. And it was never that easy to change, particularly not at that point in your life.
Just click on something you just said there about honesty and shame. I think you see that, you know, in the show as well, but I think it will always be relevant. And especially during that time, and of course it still exists now in so many different cultures, when you're so repressed and you're taught from such a young age, your earliest memories are, you know, you being told that you should be ashamed. You should feel, you know, or have you got no shame? That you think you can live this lifestyle and love the person that you're loving and sleep with the person that you're loving. But what that can do to someone, and what I know from, you know, reading notes of phone calls from the LGBT switchboard, what it did to these young boys and men there, that they couldn't talk about it. And because they couldn't talk about it, they ended up making decisions and mistakes because they didn't love themselves and they didn't think they deserved anything better. Also, what you said about education, about educating people that aren't from those groups or feel that, oh, well, this doesn't really affect me. That still exists now. We can see that in all subjects, in race and sexuality and everything. And that's why today I think it's so key for these conversations to be entering schools. It's so, so important. And that's what I find myself, and we've all said it to each other, being touched by the most. Young girls and boys and people across all genders contacting me and saying how amazing it is that they can watch a series like this in school. Like, oh my God, like for me, when I was like, I'm 26, when I was in school, I had to like secretly search like, oh, which lesbian movies exist, and secretly watch it on YouTube. And it's like, but for something mainstream like that to exist now, it's so important, where the lead guy in a series is a gay man, and in real life, he's openly gay. And his heartthrob love interest, Ash, is a tall South Asian guy, and where the powerful, you know, lawyer who helps, person who rescues, is a woman, first of all, and also a British Asian woman. Those things didn't exist, and by showing them on screen, you're showing audience members that they can exist and do those things. And yeah, I think that's really, yeah, key.
You know, Sayan, I'm feeling emotional hearing you even talk about that representation. It's so amazing and it's so fantastic that we get to see it nowadays. And I think we'll probably touch a bit more on visibility and education towards the end of our conversation when we look to the future. But just going back to the past for a second, you know, words that have come up from both yourself and Kerry are shame, stigma, repression. And I think the overwhelming feeling I've been left with from It's a Sin and all the subsequent reading I've done about this time period has actually been anger. And so I want to ask you, Sayan, what it was like stepping away from that production and the emotions you were left with. And then Kerry, similarly, what you felt when you were moving on in life, you know, when this period was coming to an end of you working for Immunity and the emotions you were left with, because the anger in me was overwhelming. So I can only imagine how both of you were feeling.
Mm-hmm. What I felt strongly when I was reading it was, first of all, why wasn't I taught this in school? why did I never know about this time period? Why does it seem almost as if it was blotted out? Why isn't this mainstream, both in mainstream education and mainstream, entertainment in film and TV? Why did it more exist? I felt upset that I didn't know about these people. And then feeling horrified over the way that they were treated. That feeling really came from the documentaries. I watched this American documentary, I believe it was from the late 60s or early 70s, where they were examining the gay man and what makes him gay and how you can pick him out on the street and what he can give you. And I was disgusted. How did you get airtime? How are you there? How is this on screen? And then with Lisbeth specifically, I remember telling, not friends, acquaintance, about her. And the first thing they said was, oh no, that gay Muslim women wouldn't have existed then, Seon. And I was like, what? Of course they would have. It's not a species that's now come out of an egg and it's like, oh, I'm here. This has always existed. But if you look at history, like I'm Indian, the Kama Sutra, come on. This is the beautiful thing that Russell has done and that I really want to share with you. I asked him, I said, is she based on anyone specific? He said, no. But what she represents is the women that did great work, like yourself, like so many, and also a call to the future of what we have coming and also what needs to be cleaned out, the cobwebs that people like her cleaned out of those hospitals, like Manchester Hospital. And finally, the feeling that stayed with me is the feeling to create change. And it needs to be created. And Russell, Pete, the director, read the production company, they're showing our industry that these stories matter. And they're showing showrunners and producers that if you put your money into these stories, there is an audience for it. And now I think the game is going to change completely with the stories that we see.
So Kerry, just following on from that, can you kind of maybe talk about some of the emotions that you were left with, after your time kind of stepping away from the sector you were working in and life moving on? Did you have some of the same emotions that Seon's expressed she had when working on this production? Talk about some of that for me, please.
So I worked for 10 years in HIV, starting in 1988, finishing in 1998. And like pretty well everybody who worked throughout that time, it was a huge amount of work, I mean, physical work. So, commonly one was looking at very long weeks of 70, 80 hours a week. But it was also completely coterminously, you were experiencing personal stuff around you. Both good and bad, I should say. I mean, there was a fantastic amount of partying and making sure that we all kind of managed to make it through the night and dance on tables and stuff, but hugely and notably bad, and lots of loss, including in my case, loss of my best friend. So, multiple funerals, which you just don't expect to have to go to at that point. So, like everybody else in the field, it was kind of exhausting. And I by 1996, which is of course when Vancouver and the ARVs was kind of announced, I was already very tired. It also for me coincided, and it's this is a kind of personal story I don't want to go into in much detail, but I ended up myself diagnosed HIV positive in 1996. So, talk about the collision of the professional and the personal, it's all there really. And so I needed, to get away. But I think also, there was a moment where the field that, so what happened in the HIV AIDS field was there was this explosion, absolute explosion of self-help and creativeness and, groups everywhere, and the London Lighthouse and Terence Hicks Trust and Landmark and blah, blah, blah. Organisations up and down the country. And quite reasonably, after the advent of ARVs, all of that began to be rationalised. And so you were looking at a much more professionalized sector and a sector which was much more looking at HIV as a long-term medical condition. It didn't mean all the battles had been won, far from it, but you know, the sector was, by then it had grown up a bit, and to put it mildly, was in fantastically safe hands. So yeah, I moved on then.
I hope you don't mind. I just kind of wanted to express like how I felt watching the show, because especially like as a kind of a queer person who's in lockdown, as we all are, like the community I felt from watching the show, and it just reminded me of like all the beauty in being queer and like all the community and stuff like that. And it obviously kind of also illuminated the gaping problems that we still face. And obviously we have spoken a lot in this conversation how things have changed, but you know, the sex education still isn't really there in school at all, and there's still quite a kind of ring fence around the queer community, the LGBT community, where it's still like, oh, if so long if it's got a rainbow on it, a flag on it, it's kind of their problem, and we're still working to really integrate it. So I wonder what both of you think, to be honest, in terms of how we move forward in collective action and kind of raising awareness that it's everyone, it's not just the community itself.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, I think the first drive is the government, and the government knowing how important it is, just as important as anything else on their syllabus for it to be integrated into. So when you have sex education, I've still got, you know, I call her my baby cousin, she's 18. And you know, when I ask her what she was taught in school, it's exactly the same thing that I was taught. You've got the egg and the sperm, stop it, cut it out. We need more. You know, there needs to be a conversation and a dialogue across the LGBTQIA about sex, because it affects your development and it affects your relationships, it affects how you see yourself. And then from a point of view of, you know, how I see it as an actor, and I think this is really key in the answer to your question, growing up, film was a way for me to escape my reality, because I needed it, I needed the escape, and it's where I got the opportunity to meet souls that I otherwise would never meet in my everyday reality. And that's what really saved me, that dialogue, those imaginary conversations. And that's what has shook me to my core of when I, you know, the outpouring of messages that I've received specifically for me, you know, of course, to my character from the Middle Eastern, Asian LGBTQIA community, of how represented they felt, how visible they felt. And it made them think that, oh my God, so, you know, you're wearing a headscarf and you and your character, you know, likes women. That means I can proudly do that. I can confidently do that. Also, people who have this platform, I think it's important for us to be open and honest about who we are in our reality. So I have definitely got loads of comments on, well, you can go on my Instagram and you can see pictures with, you know, me and my partner. It's clear that I'm with a woman. But I've got a lot of questions where people have asked me, mostly, I'll be honest, mostly family members, of why do you need to say in an interview that you're a gay woman? Why is that important? Your character is, that's enough. Why do you need to say it? The reason is, because when I was a kid and I would Google actresses to see what their sexuality was like in real life, that's not because I wanted to call them, get with them. No, I mean, I was 15. I wouldn't mean that now either. It was because I wanted to know that somebody with my sexuality, this part of my identity, could also exist in these realms and on these platforms. That's why it's important. That, and for other actors, you know, who are a bit wary of that, that doesn't in any way mean that people are going to think that, oh, you can only play a gay woman. No, it's acting. It's imagination. That's what it's all about. But by you being honest about your life, it allows other people to do the same. So I think that's where visibility is a really important thing.
You know what, Sayan, you're a better woman than I am, man, because when I was 15, I was definitely Googling some actors that I wanted to get with. There was no other motive behind those Google searches, can't even lie. But we'll move swiftly on, because as we come to the end of our conversation and we look towards the future, I think one fantastic thing about It's a Sin is that it has obviously created conversation, it's created awareness and destigmatization. But our fight is not over. Now, equally, we have made huge strides, you know, since the era that It's a Sin was set in. But, you know, homophobia still exists. There's still lots of misogyny and sexism and racism within our society. So I suppose I want to ask you both how you think we fight some of these things, and more specifically, how you think we continue to fight the destigmatization of HIV, because I think the last thing we want is to lose this momentum that It's a Sin has built up. So how do we capitalize on that?
Well, I honestly think it's about, I'm not quite sure it's about HIV even really. I think it's about the shame that's inherent in the message of conservative, with a small c, conservative values. Yeah. So, you know, kind of, this is all about the right to self, I've already said it, the right to self-determination and the right of everybody to human dignity. It's all about that. Yeah. And whether it be HIV or whether it be something else which affects us, we need to be supporting people in their life choices, whatever those may be. And the things that stop people from being happy in terms of making their life choices are the messages which are bombarded at them from early ages from a variety of sources, including sadly still education. And it's much better now, much better, as Sayan has said, in terms of the representation of role models, and you know, something like It's a Sin and various other kind of series, it's marvelous that those are on now, which they weren't before. But still, we need more of that. And it's not the full picture. You know, the full picture is who's making the decisions. Where are the people in power? Where are the women? Where are the queer people? Where are the people of colour? Mm-hmm. Essentially, the country's still run by white men.
There you go. And I think that's where it is, my answer in a nutshell. You know, when I spoke about the 80s being a decade of state-sanctioned homophobia, it's looking back to the state, looking at the highest powers, religious organisations, I think is a key one, governments, yeah. People who run our country. What are their views? So what are their views? That being questioned, that being brought up as a question in Parliament, that's not an outlandish idea that I'm saying here. That's very real. And that is a very real petition. That's a very real reason. So that conversation happening in government, making sure that we use this momentum of It's a Sin, how groundbreaking it is to push for that. Push for that conversation to become bigger in schools, push for that conversation to become bigger in religious groups, which characters like Elizabeth has done, as she's a queer Muslim character. And it needs to be pushed here. Conversations that seem uncomfortable to groups, that's where it needs to be pushed. And that momentum needs to keep going. And anyone who's listening to this, you know, your visibility is so important, and your safety is important, and it's important for people to know that there's people out there that can help you in that. And we have amazing organizations like ACT UP, Stonewall, the LGBT Switchboard. Please reach out to them.
So that brings this episode to a close. I hope you enjoyed, everyone. If you want to know more about our guests and where you can find them, you can check out Transmission Roundhouse on Instagram at @transmission_RH, and you can find Fluid at Fluid Podcast.
And if you want to get in touch with Queer Ear, we're at Queer Ear Podcast on Instagram and Twitter as well.